This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Greetings from snowy Florida, where none of us are happy about the snow. And by none of us, I mean me, even though it's not snowing directly by me. And welcome to this bright winter day podcast episode of Florida Spectacular. Hopefully you're listening in warmer weather. How are you, Rick?
I'm enjoying watching the videos of people in northern Florida freezing their butts off in the snow. A friend sent me video from Pensacola, and it looks gorgeous. And I've never seen so much snow on the ground in Florida before, ever.
I haven't either. And I mean, what did I say this morning to somebody? We're not on fire. We're not flooded out. Just be grateful. you got to take the winds where you get it. And it's not snowing by me. So I'm very happy about that. As we sit in our toasty warm homes, I hope you're toasty warm in your attic, although I suspect it's a bit drafty. We have a guest today, Joy Wallace Dickinson. She has written a book, and she has a little history, little Florida. I'm excited. She's been on the podcast before for the Now Classic episode 117, and you'll just have to look in the show notes for that gem. But her book is called Secrets of the Flamingo Cafe, an Old Florida Mystery. So welcome, Joy. Welcome back. How are you?
Good. I'm good. I like the cold weather. I like it more when it's sunny and bright rather than rainy, but which it is here. I'm in Orlando and we have rain, no snow. But anyway, I get invigorated at least for a while by it. So
where were you born?
I was born in Pennsylvania, but we moved here when I was a small child. So I am forever, you know, stamped by Florida when I have lived in colder states during my life. I stupidly sort of just put on a sweater, you know, and go outside without realizing that some places you need to have a hat and gloves and a scarf. But Virginia was really about as cold as I ever got in terms of living, visited other places.
Virginia or San Francisco, you know, well, I love San Francisco, but that's a cold place.
Cold in a different way. Yeah. What is it? The famous quote, I'm supposed to be Mark Twain. The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco. But that's another story, I guess.
There is a great quote, and I'm going to mangle it horribly. It's in one of Tom Corcoran's novels. I think it was in the Mango Opera, his amateur detective in his mysteries. Alex Rutledge makes a comment that, they should have told me when I was young that hell was cold with frostbitten fingers and freezing temperatures. You know, heat is a pain in the ass, but cold plain hurts. And if they had told me hell was cold, I would have lived a different life entirely. And I think about that a lot when it's like this, because like with you, Joy, it's raining where I am. It's been raining for almost 24 hours and it is in the low 40s. And I was born in New York. My parents moved to Florida when I was 7. The coldest weather I've ever lived in, other than that, is Orlando. So I am supremely unsuited for this. I am unsuited for anything below 70, but I accept that we are going to have temperatures in the 60s and sometimes the 50s. 40 is unacceptable. 40 is patently not why I bought this ticket. I want off the ride. Not what we're selling people when they move to Florida. We're not selling them this weather. I saw a picture, I-10 at the Alabama, between I-10 and the Alabama state line, they have a welcome to Florida sign and it was covered in snow. And I'm thinking, man, that is not what we are telling people this is about.
I feel like it's up to me to segue away from our weather podcast
But the weather's so bad. I just need a moment to get that out. Yes.
Okay.
Let's talk about a burning hot mystery. It will make us warm.
One of the things I really loved about it was that it's set in summer before air conditioning. And most people, you know, who haven't lived in Florida for a long period of time cannot imagine living in Florida without air conditioning. And Joy, one of the things you do so well in the book is you remind us these people are here when there's no air conditioning in the summer, which is hard for, I think, most Florida residents today to even consider.
Well, yeah, I was thinking too when we were talking about the theme of people moving from New York. My protagonist is from New York, but people moving from New York to Florida and the sort of tensions between, there are all kinds of tensions, but between, you know, the population in the area, in the town that the book is set in, between the people who've lived there for a long time and the people that they cater to, their visitors, which are ubiquitous, and many from the north is one of the themes. But considering this is overall sort of a light mystery on purpose, I hope it's a light mystery with some deeper themes. But in the very first scene, that the character at the center of the mystery gets off the train, and it's maybe late September, and the train car is air conditioned, but anyway, she feels like she just has this blast of heat, and feels like she stepped into the gates of hell, which is a quote directly from my own mother.
I mean, I think even you have a nice way of reinforcing it. And in chapter two, she wakes up, Emily wakes up, and you make the point, it was early and she was already damp with perspiration. You know, she packed the wrong clothes, even wearing nothing felt too heavy. I get that.
Yeah, her fiance, who's a whole other topic, at one point he appears unexpectedly wearing a fur coat, which is just one sign of his sort of cluelessness about where he is, but also his picture of Florida. He's a wealthy New Yorker, so a lot of those things. And you know, it's interesting, Kathy, about being from New York. I thought about it. I think particularly, you know, I mean, I'm speaking of growing up in Orlando, but somehow I managed to always live in tourist towns, or towns that their economy was really dependent on tourists, especially I lived in Williamsburg, Virginia for a time. So there's always this, you know, this feeling like, sure, we're happy they're here and we've got these businesses and we've got our motels and our restaurants and we want them to be here. But in other ways, you know, there used to be a bumper sticker. I'm not sure if it was real or apocryphal, but I think I remember seeing it saying, "We don't care how you did it up north."
You know? Yes, we don't care how you do it up north.
We don't care how you do it up north. And you know, I think that's a tension that still exists in a lot of ways. It's very interesting. I could go off on all kinds of tangents, so I'm going to depend on you all to keep me.
Well, it just depends. If it comforts you, I have just this week called somebody a carpetbagger.
So you know, I did a book talk this week, and a lot of it was based on this research by a guy named John Foster, who talks about these abolitionist writers who came into Northeast Florida and really kind of laid the foundation for the growth of modern Florida. And it was that northern capital that was infused by those tourists coming from up north that kind of reinvigorated the state. And so maybe that we need to relook at that whole term of carpetbaggers, because, you know, the state was devastated after the Civil War. There was the economy was in shambles. And then these people started coming down on steamboats, going to the spas, and they started building hotels. And that kind of laid the groundwork for Flagler and Plant.
It's not so much what they did. I believe it is the methods with which they achieved it.
No, I think there were some that you know, were not good. But I also think, you know, we look at people who came in and took advantage of what was here in Florida before the Civil War, and they're not called carpetbaggers, but, you know, afterwards they are. So other digression again.
Well, I mean, okay. So I think if I'm remembering high school history correctly, It had to do with investing in the local economy versus capitalizing on and pulling all the money out of the local economy. The idea that the carpetbagger would come in, exploit the local landscape, and keep the money. Whereas when, say, Plant or Flagler came down, that was a situation where the wealth was spread around, right? So they would build a hotel, they would employ people. It was a little bit different.
It's complicated. It's
It's
complicated. But no,
that's the t-shirt. It's complicated.
you have some valid points for sure. For sure.
It is not my big hill, but it is a hill for me.
Yeah, we should probably get away from Reconstruction. It's
It's yeah, it's so Joy, tell us about the dead person in your book. How about that? Happy topics.
If I'm giving anything away, if I say there's more than one dead person in my book, but I mean the book's set in the 40s. And in the late 40s, after World War II. And I mean, I think some of these themes are, we're talking about Northerners or people from other places who invest in Florida and make money out of it. But there have always been plenty of folks who are willing to, Floridians who are willing to join that. And one of the themes in the book and the central locale is a place, called the Flamingo Cafe, which is very loosely in the book based on a real place that was in Orlando, but also tied into sort of the underworld of Florida and its history of gambling and illegal gambling and payoffs to people to protect the illegal gambling. And we suspect in the book at root, or there's hint of some of those folks that are taking the money are legal, I mean are local. The fictional proprietor of the Flamingo Cafe and a young man of some glamour has been in a family who's been doing this for at least 25 years, since the 20s when this nightclub started with backstage secret gambling, supposedly in the back of the building. But there's a good chance that that money is going to folks that have their that may be out of guess where. New York City, or connected with national networks of under the underworld. So, I think that there has always been this streak of underground crime in Florida. I looked up when I was thinking about how many great mystery books and crime books have been based in Florida for a long time, and one of the sort of granddaddies of it, John D. McDonald, was described by Carl Hiaasen as the first modern writer to nail Florida dead center to capture all its languid sleaze, racy sense of promise, and breath-grabbing beauty. So the racy sense of promise, is sort of in there too. Now, one the book centers around the death that's happened before the book began of a woman who was a New Yorker, an artist who moved to Central Florida in the 20s, very much a sort of bohemian, bought an orange grove, became very much a part of the local community, but always somewhat of an iconoclast, tangled with the KKK. And when the book begins, she has died, and in what has been publicly announced as an accident in a fire, and that's what her niece thinks has happened when she arrives. But pretty soon, the niece finds out that there are folks that have concerns that it wasn't an accident, and in order to really inherit her aunt's estate, she has to do some things that her aunt asks her to do, and one of those things is to sort of, if anything happens to her, to look into it, and also to start an art show. So, art. This woman is an artist. Her niece, who's our heroine or protagonist, is an artist. So that's a little bit center of the book. But as is the underworld, the underground gambling, all kinds of things, and the rocky relationship between the Black community and the white community, the ongoing. So it's set right after World War II, and which is a one of the many transformative periods, I think, in Florida. So.
Absolutely. That is one of the Florida historian Gary Mormino makes the case that that is one of the reasons Florida changed is the way it did. So,
After World War II.
World War II itself is
Oh.
that.
Oh, yeah, all the people that were stationed here, the huge number of bases. I think that's true. And so the war, the people in the book have all come through the war. Some have had losses, very deep losses. They're, that's it's sort of provides part of the backdrop of it. And are recovering now in this period of sort of post-war optimism, where blue skies ahead and growth and happy times in Florida. But there are, as I said, the dark strains that run, dark shadows that run in the sunshine. It's almost everybody's written a mystery book about Florida ends up saying it at one time. There are dark shadows in the sunshine.
There's a big alligator in it, so I love that, of
Well, I
course.
tried to get in. I mean, it's really, one of the reasons that I did this was to have fun with it, and I tried to get in a lot of the Florida memes that
You got flamingos, you got alligators.
you gotta have the big alligator. And I mean, that's not necessarily true of all of it, but yeah, there's the big alligator, there's the cattle whip, the story of the cracker cowboys or cow hunters. So I think one of the tricks of and just one of the tricks of writing a mystery that in which you try to set it in a historical setting in Florida and you hope that people will learn something about Florida during that time is that how to weave that in without it becoming disruptive to the narrative and also to the what's happening, which is really, we hope, basically a story about people that readers will come to be interested in. So
Yeah. So how much is it of the, because, I'm an, to me, this book is set in Orlando. The train station is, our downtown train station. And
I think it
when
even
they,
says, or I ended up, and it even says Orlando in some
okay.
places. Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of the places, it's, to me, it's like the Maitland Arts Center is a big part of it. Clearly it's downtown Orlando. And in the Flamingo Cafe is a real place, right?
Flamingo Cafe was a real place, and you can was a real place. Started, I think, in the late 20s. It started in stages. The man who owned the real Flamingo Cafe owned a business downtown before that, and but built this nightclub on the outskirts. And it's really funny, Rick, when you think about it. It was outside the city limits, which was about where Herndon Avenue is now. And on Colonial, it was on Colonial, which was the Cheney Highway then, and so it was purposely outside the city limits, so city laws didn't apply to it, I think, but they considered it way out of town, and it was a Spanish Mediterranean building, and the biggest nightclub advertised as, and I believe it, the biggest nightclub in Orlando. It bears certain. Clearly, the book, the nightclub Flamingo Cafe in the book is based on it, and there were certain things that were very real, but I think my version of it is a little bit more glamorous. Although it was a big nightclub, and it did have a back room where people could engage in casino gambling if you were let in back there. And I learned about it and that part of it anyway from there was a I think it's 1957, a big article in the Sentinel's Florida magazine by a man named Henry Balch, who was one of the Sentinel's editors for a really long time. And this was a Sunday magazine feature, and he's writing about the Flamingo Cafe and lays out the whole thing and the story. And I mean, it always amused me when I think later people was easy to assume that there was nothing in terms of entertainment or nightlife or anything in Orlando before Disney. But nightclubs like this, were small, but they imported bands from Havana. They had chefs. They featured. There was clearly a link in which they were trying to refer to, the real nightlife in Miami and Havana, which had a lot of a connection with Florida in the 40s and on in the 50s until Castro. I mean, there were weekly ads in the paper of vacation excursions to Havana and on ships and go down there and gamble. And a friend, an old friend from childhood who came to one the book unveiling, Rick, said, "Didn't I remember that our parents used to go to Havana together?" And I didn't remember that. I knew a lot of things they had done together, but I guess maybe they did at least once. So if you wanted to be have a night spot, you would appoint entertainment. You'd have a big band. You'd of course have plenty of interesting things to drink. And in the case of the Flamingo Cafe, you'd even had a room with I mean roulette wheels, the whole deal. And Henry Bulge described all that in his article, including how you could see everybody there, including the mayor. And he was talking about the 30s and 40s, I think, primarily. And what would happen, and it happens in the book, but I think it happened in real life too, is certain amounts of money would just be handed over to people in law enforcement, and they'd say, "Good, have a good time." They might appear, for a sort of pro forma raid once in a while. But basically, it was a situation where everybody was happy to have a good time and make money. And a lot of the best people in town went. I talked to a couple of ladies who had been there. I mean, who are now my mother's age are probably no longer with us. They'd been to dinner and didn't even certainly the backstage gambling was generally men only. The deal was you'd go to dinner, probably all dressed up, and maybe listen to something in the floor show, dance with your wife or a company, lady friend once or so, and zip off into the back to, gamble a little bit, maybe come back and forth. One thing I did steal from that's in the book is Balch described the gentleman, a very avuncular older gentleman who presided over the gambling casino part of it as looking like Santa Claus and sort of Colonel Sanders type, who was sort of the maitre d' of the backstage gambling room, and I put him in the book. I mean, I just used the description. I thought it made sense that, of course, if you were running, if you were smart and you were running an operation like that, you'd have somebody presiding over it who looked just as respectable and kind as and comforting as anything, and greet everybody very graciously. So, anyway, I think that in talking about it, that's one of the things that's most interesting to people is to talk about the Flamingo Cafe. But man, I have been amazed at how many people, even people my age and older, are shocked to find out that people took bribes in Orlando and that there were gangsters here.
Yeah, you think about that. I know the Tampa area has a much better documented connection to that kind of stuff. And of course, the bad gangsters in the book are come over from Tampa, and that's like they're the big, at a different level from the Orlando gangsters.
Oh,
And
come on, you're being you don't disparage Tampa gangsters. They're
no,
lovely. Don't
I'm
disparage
saying.
Orlando gangsters either. And there's a new book that's published by the University Press, and I can't remember the name, but it is about the Florida Mafia, and it does have a chapter about our own local in Orlando, Kingpin Harlan Blackburn, which is a name that I don't think you could make up if you, I mean, that's for a gangster kingpin, Harlan Blackburn, who was the head of the so-called, they called it the Cracker Mafia in this area. And he, of course, he had ties to folks who operated out of Tampa and other places, including Santo Trafficante, who was supposedly the godfather of Florida, but he is not in the book. So
And the other thing you had that has a ring of truth is the corrupt sheriff, because I know that we had a sheriff who was involved in Klan activities in Orange County, and then there was, of course, the notorious sheriff in Lake County who Gilbert King has written about. And it's interesting to me that you chose a name right out of Orlando history, Mizell, for the sheriff, too.
Yeah, I think one of the things, there are several characters in the book, not only the bad sheriff, but some good people, and including there's a young boy who's a sort of main character, and he's a Mizell, too. I think I just like saying that, Mizell. I thought about it. It was a big family and an old family, and involved in, Kathy, involved in this infamous Barbara Mizell feud that went back deep into Orlando history of the 1870s. Interestingly enough, and, you know, I've never run across this person. I was thinking many years ago when my mom was still with us, she had a heart attack and which she survived. But anyway, we ended up in the emergency room. She was younger than I am. We ended up in the emergency room at ORMC, used to be Orange Memorial Hospital, but one of the big hospital systems here. And her doctor was a Mizell. And so I just, you know, I remembered I was very much focused on whether she was going to make it through the night. But I did note his name was Mizell. You know. Anyway, so big family. Yeah, I did. I think naming characters is an interesting thing. And one that in terms of the prescriptions of fiction, good fiction writing, I probably was a little timid about. One wonderful writing teacher, John Dufresne, who's just published a new book, but he says to really spend a lot of time on your characters and try to come up with memorable names, you know, Holden Caulfield. And I mean, names on that level. And I think I didn't, I certainly didn't achieve that. But I wanted to make names that were sort of the period and had some local flavor. Armistead, too, who's a black character. There was an Armistead family who was very much affected by the Ocoee riot. But I didn't necessarily mean to make this gentleman connected to that family. But that's an old name that's been around. But names are. Naming characters is interesting. I think one of the things I said in the book, in the acknowledgments, was I really never thought I would write fiction. In some ways, I was intimidated by it. I used to write a history column for the Sentinel for a long time, and I could handle sort of a thousand words of nonfiction. But I got to interview Patrick Smith, the beloved author of A Land Remembered, when he got this, I think it was 2003, he got this big award from the Florida Historical Society. Somebody had given them a grant or something to name the greatest living Floridian or something. People voted, and Patrick Smith won by a lot and was pretty late in his life. But anyway, I got to talk to him, and he told me that when he named his characters, that they sort of started talking to him. I mean, internally, that the name was the key thing, and that when they were real to him, they would in some ways become real to him. And I remember thinking, well, I love Patrick Smith, but that sounds sort of like a load of hooey in some way. But boy, did I have that same experience. Somehow, you know, some of them start getting pretty real and telling you what they think they ought to be doing in your head anyway.
So I have fiction that I have not published, but I have a very similar experience. I was reading a book, Anne Rice, who wrote The Vampire Chronicles, for a time had stopped writing about one of her very popular characters, Lestat, and in fact has him for several books basically prostrate in a church, on his, you know, full on in front of the cross, like just almost comatose. And when asked about it, she says, "I have no other way to describe it, but I was walking down the street one day and Lestat left me." And I remember thinking, well, that sounds a little cuckoo. Yeah. And then I started writing fiction, and I actually had the thought, oh, am I cuckoo? Am I losing my mind? Like, It's a very weird thing where you feel like you are not in control of what your characters are doing, and of course you are, right? But yeah, that's my friends will t my friends who write fiction say that's how you know you're onto something good.
Well, it's a wonder, it's a cool experience. What happened to me in this book was that it's really one of the main characters. He's really one of the main characters, Milton Armistead. In fact, on the cover of the book, it says, you know, if there are more of these, he's like the second main character. And he was just going to be a guy who picked my character Emily up at the train station. He was just a very minor character, and then all of a sudden he sort of, you know, it seemed like he took center stage and or you know became a much more interesting character and person than I had originally. So I think that's part of the fun of it to me. I don't know if you found it that way, Kathy, is when you can get into it at that level and you know have it sort of flow for you. There are plenty of times when I found like it was, you know, certainly not flowing and really
Yes.
an effort.
I look for it now. I'm excited. I look for it. If I don't start to feel like I'm cracking up a little bit while I'm writing because I'm out of control, I don't feel like I'm doing a good job, which is probably not a great metric. But anyway. So this is fun. I think we've gone over a lot about the books, but we haven't asked you specifically what motivated you to write this book.
Well, long I'm thinking I've thought a little bit about that. I am a big mystery reader. It was you know, I think this is true. It's almost it is a cliche, but it's true for a lot of women my age that your first m an early exposure to books and reading were the Nancy Drew books. And I don't know when I read my first one, but when I was about 10 years old. And Orlando's changed so much. It's amazing to imagine a 10-year-old doing this. I might be, but the book Ivy's Department Store, which is a building that's still in use,
Ivy's, wow, okay.
had a book department, and I would get my allowance and maybe with my mother. But you know, it wasn't unheard of for leave to leave kids off and let them, you know, do their own thing for a couple of hours or so, and then pick them up. At that time, maybe a little older than 12, 10. But anyway, I would buy Nancy Drew books and read them all. And those books were really influential for young girls in that they showed a heroine who was adventurous, doing things on her own, solving mysteries. But she had a sharp, she was a teenager in the books, but old enough to drive. She had the sharp blue roadster, which in some ways the car that my hero and drives protagonist drives is a little bit of a tip to that, to the convertible that Nancy went tooling around. And so, you know, in some ways I grew up, have always read, enjoyed reading mystery books as a genre, for years and years and years. And I always thought I'd like to try my hand at writing one, I think. And when I first started making notes, which were many years ago and everything, I thought, well, this is, you know, I know all this stuff about Orlando history. I can just write mysteries and put it in there. But I think the journey to learning to write fiction, or at least a little bit writing this book anyway, showed me how interesting that is. And you know, in order to make it a compelling book people want to read, or somewhat compelling anyway, you know, you really need to create characters who are doing things. You can't just have them be sort of cardboard and then throw in a paragraph about, you know, I don't know what, Gatorland or something, or, you know, something else that you feel like I know a lot about and I'd like to throw this in. So the weaving of the two together is interesting, but that's more part of the process. So, I think one of the things Rick's asked me about, or too, is why is the so-called period research. But I picked a period that, because of my parents and moving here in the 40s, I sort of knew a good amount about by osmosis, which was my family moved here in 1949. This is set in 1947 or 48, same period, basically. And so in some ways, it's a bit of a homage to them and their generation, because they were the World War II generation, and they would be about the same age as the people in the book, and sort of the people, those people who came to Florida. So I suspected that had something to do with it too. It was a world I knew, and in some ways paying tribute to them. But I tried to follow some of the tropes of the kinds of mysteries like this. I would, if I were talking to a bookseller, I'd still call it a cozy mystery. Although, I mean, people are killed in it, and there is a bit of blood, but it's not a cozy mystery. Is typically a mystery that's set in a sort of closed world. A lot of them are in English villages. I mean, it's not like not a big city. A lot of people know each other. The violence is typically not. It is typically sort of genteel. I mean, it's not
It's off screen usually too, isn't it?
off screen. There's no exploding heads or I don't know.
No good B movie fodder is what you're saying.
Right. So anyway, but that's I think there are certain things that those kind of books, and also the Florida book, the big alligator, some of the Florida tropes
Yeah.
that I try to weave in.
Well, I love any Florida mysteries, and I'm sure people are who have read the book are already enjoying it, but it is still fairly new, is it not?
Yeah, it's new, and it's new, and I had published a Kindle. If there's a Kindle edition of it on
There
Amazon,
is for $5.
$5, that's easily available, and
And we're going to definitely put the link to that in the show notes. And it says
that
this is
would be
book one,
great.
and it can't. I was
Great.
going to say it came out last year, but I guess it was 2023 and we're not in 2024 anymore. So technically it came out 2 years ago, but barely, because it's January.
The
When does
Kindle
the second
edition did. The print
hard
edition.
the print edition is just came out and just came out and is in very minor ways has some changes from the Kindle edition. But I mean, it's basically the same story. The hardcover edition has some little
There's still
flourishes.
dead bodies, things like that, you
Oh
promise?
yeah, it's pretty much the same story.
And when do we get book two?
That is a good question.
I know I hate that question. So when's your next book out? Up yours,
I
don't ask
know,
me.
and I have to do a little teaser because I know it's going to be about a certain spiritualist town
The
that's north of Central Florida that we may know of.
does
I
it
think
rhyme with Pasagaga?
Great. Yeah, the title of this one, I know I only you guys can see it, but is The Secrets of the Flamingo Cafe, as you mentioned. The title of the second one will be Murder Among the Mediums, and our heroes are take off to Casadega to and be become in embroiled in the adventures of a rather glamorous medium who's taking the world by storm, both in Orlando and Casadega. That's again something else I know a little bit about from just my life. When I was in high school, it was not uncommon for those folks who thought they were sophisticated and had access to a car to go to Casadega to have a reading on a date, even. It wasn't every day, but I knew people who did it, and I think there were a great many particular ladies from Orlando who went to Casadega for readings, and that's one of the themes of the book. So that's the next book in the series. But yeah, I think the best way to do one of these is to write them all and then write them all and release them. If you could write like a bunch of them and then release them, because if people like them, they do want to read the next one, which I love. I mean, that's great. But
Yeah, Florida author Tara Lush says the best thing to do is have three ready to go. So.
yeah, I think that's probably right. But I am just grateful to even have one published. I'm the publisher. I love doing that too. I used to be a book designer, so I really loved typesetting the book and sort of and a certain really good friend of mine who's a graphic designer did the wonderful cover, and his name's Rick Kilby.
I've met that guy.
He's among his many talents. And so he did just the perfect cover for it, and that was fun. So I enjoyed the process of sort of, you know, bringing it into fruition. And as a lifelong person who loves to, I don't know if it's because I'm an Aries or not, love to start things, not good at finishing, was just happy to have it available. So,
gotcha.
And I will say, because I've been kind of behind the scenes on this, you know, this isn't something that Joy just slapped out. She's been working on it for years. And, you know, I also want to give her credit. She has several books that are nonfiction, you know, about Orlando history, Acadia Press. And then there's this one big photo book, and there's a smaller book that are based on her columns that you can find probably online. So, but this, you know, Joy really worked hard at learning the craft of writing fiction and went to a lot of workshops. And so I've kind of been behind the scenes working on that. But for me, I don't do digital reading. I don't have a Kindle or any of that kind of stuff. I like to have the book in my hands, and Joy put a lot of energy into that. You know, it's got a dust cover, and it's hardbound. It's not softbound. It's like a real book, you know, it's real substantial, and it's a whole, to me, it's a different product, and it's high quality. You know, we've talked on our podcast before about the difference between, you know, self-publishing and using a conventional publisher. To me, this feels like something a conventional publisher created because the quality of the print book is so high. And I just want to say that if you want to plunk down a couple extra bucks, that it's worth holding this book in your hand.
You Luddite, you're charming.
It is. Joy worked very hard on it. And I did a number of covers, and I knew exactly what she was after, because there is a look of that era, you know, that is, you know, and it took me forever to find the right font, and really it's just a type treatment more than anything. But I'm glad that she appreciated it, because and I'm glad to be part of it, because I think it's a super cool work, and it really makes that period come alive. You know, I think as Orlandoans, you try and distance yourself from the Disney thing, like that's really not part of Orlando. And there's this whole community that has a very interesting past that just kind of gets ignored. And to shine a light on that, I think is a real accomplishment. You know, I have to admit, I've never thought much about like organized crime and gambling and stuff in Orlando, where I have, you know, obviously it seems like it's more the DNA in the Tampa area and Ybor and all that kind of stuff because of, you know, that book that came out that you talked about and stuff. So to see it in a new light, I think, is a real gift to local history lovers here in Central Florida.
Well, thanks. I mean, it was a time of, I was thinking about it, tensions between a lot of things, including racial tensions. I mean,
yeah.
And that is one of the runs through the book too. And it, you know, some of the characters are African-American, and it's still in an incredibly segregated time. I mean, this is before the assassination of Harry T. and Harriet Moore, just a couple of years, but also around the time that President Truman opened the military to Black soldiers, integrated the military, and things were, change was even, was in the air, and, you know, and it would, came as a blow to people in this very rigid, some of the white people having control of this very rigidly controlled society. So there are some larger themes running through it, but I hope people will have fun with it too. A fun story.
Well, I hope they get out and read it soon, and we'll have the definite link in the show notes. Thank you, Joy, for being here today.
Always.
And Rick, thanks for designing her cover. It's beautiful.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always fun to talk to you guys and you know, enjoy the show very much. I still think of it as a show. I had a friend recently say, I don't understand podcasts. I said, it's a radio show.
it's a radio show that you can listen to anytime. It's the best type of radio.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I Before we go, I want to let our paid listeners know that this week I sent out our first little bit of swag, our Florida Splaining bookmark. But I need, if you are a paid listener, please, we've emailed you twice looking for your physical address. We cannot mail you things without a physical address. But Rick and I want to thank you for listening and supporting us with your hard-earned dollars. And we'll just thank our first few listeners, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Lisa, Leslie Hallweg, Davita Breyer, author of Sinkhole, Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bone, I'm pretty sure I'm not saying that name right, Ryan Worthington of the Florida Madcaps podcast, and Michael Gargulak. So thanks for listening. You can always hop on over to buzzsprout.com, find our podcast, support us with your, as I say, hard-earned monies, and we have presents for all of you. For those of you who have signed up for the Backroads Tripper, that's the $5 a month podcast, I'm headed down to the Keys. I'm giving a talk at Books and Books the end of January, and I will be sending you postcards from the road. So go on over to the Buzzsprout site and sign up and support us there. Thanks so much for everybody who does.
Wow, that's a lot going on. Ryan Worthington is undoubtedly on the road someplace. Next week, I'm excited. We're going to be talking about another area of Central Florida that has a lot of interesting historical places, Ormond Beach.
So, Ormond Beach. That's right. We've got a guest for next week. I love Ormond Beach.
I do too.
Anyway. All right, folks. That'll do it for us this week. Have a lovely week. Stay warm. If you are in Florida and it's snowing where you are, please do not drive in the snow. You might know how to do it, but I assure you there are a lot of people like me who do not, and they're probably going to try it anyway. So order a pizza, stay inside.
Don't they have to deliver the pizza through the snow, though?
But that's not your problem. If you're listening to the podcast, if you order the pizza, you're not the one getting it. It's okay.
Okay.
All right. We'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular. Thanks for listening.
Bye.